The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts for today. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the last host today, Michael Scavarla of Penn State University.
I love the energy you bring to being the Omega host every time, Mike.
You know, every time we do the call-in, I debate up until the last second, and I do not know myself what I'm going to do until it comes out of my mouth.
That is the sign of true professionalism, and I appreciate it.
It really is.
Do you ever think of just jumping in being the second host?
We've done that in the past.
Yeah, sometimes
it throws everything off.
I know. Sometimes I feel like just not saying anything and see what you do.
I like how we're doing this because we actually have a guest today.
It's true. We have a very special guest.
We have an amazing guest.
I am very excited. Arthropod All-Star, former guest of the show, friend of the show, Dr. David Coyle. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit to the crowd?
Certainly. Hello, folks. Thanks for having me again. Dave Coyle, Clemson University. I'm an assistant professor there. Forest health and invasive species is my thing. And I've been here, 3 years now? I've been in the Deep South for, coming up on 11 this stint and 4 before. So like 15 total years down here in the Carolinas and Georgia.
Are you from there originally?
No, I am not. I'm from Minnesota. So it was the first trip down, you know, I got a job right after my master's with the Forest Service down in at the Savannah River site, which is just across the river from Augusta, Georgia. And I worked there 4.5 years and I was still very much hearty Midwestern Scandinavian stock. And I thought, how can anyone live here? It's too hot. All you do is sweat. I belong where it's cold. And so then I went back to Wisconsin for my PhD. And during that time, we had some brutally cold winters and my field research was up in the Upper Peninsula. And I remember thinking, what in the heck am I doing here? This is ridiculous. Like, it's freezing all the time. And there was one, I remember when like everything churned. I was walking to campus and I was crossing these railroad tracks from where I parked. And it was like minus 118. It was sleeting or something. My face was freezing. I had hair at the time and that was frozen. And it was at that point I was like, I don't belong here. This is ridiculous. Like, there's nothing keeping me here. And so when I got a chance for a postdoc at Georgia, I came down and like basically left my winter coat up there.
That's awesome.
Peace, I'm out.
I feel like I found the happy medium, Kentucky, the transitional climatic zone. Like I get a little bit of both.
It was in the 40s this morning when I took the kids to school and I'm just like, oh, this is ridiculous out here. It's going to be 70 later, so it's cool.
Oh my gosh.
This has been Meteorology Cast with Dr. David Coyle.
That's right, yeah.
David, have you been called a damn Yankee ever in your travels down there in the South?
Perfect. Yeah. And not so much this last stint, but when I first moved to South Carolina, I had a super thick Minnesota accent, like the movie Fargo. Like that's literally how I talk and how my relatives still talk. And so there was this communication barrier between me and all the locals who were super thick, sort of country South Carolina accent. Neither of us knew what we were saying. A lot of times we were smiling, so you're clearly happy to be there, but there was a lot of miscommunication. I remember one in particular, I was talking to this guy, this big old guy named Cody, who wore bib overalls like every day. And he was putting in a big irrigation system and we were talking about, you know, just whatever. And he said, yeah, when I get done, I want to start a picayune farm. And I kept thinking, what the hell's a picayune? And then SLS was like, what's a picayune? He's like, you know, you pick your strawberries, pick your blueberries. I was like, oh, pick your own. That's what it is. Stuff like that. Not a picayune.
That is awesome.
I was like, is that a fruit or something? I had never heard of that. So we figured it out. Yeah, then they could never, a lot of people couldn't, you know, I told them I moved down from Iowa. You know, one guy was like, you mean with the girl with the potatoes? I'm like, no, that's Idaho. true story, by the way. I was like, no, that's Idaho. That's like way farther west. I said, yeah, come back east of it. And that's to Iowa. He's like, so the Buckeyes. And I was like, no, you went too far. You're in Ohio. I said, come right back. I was like, Iowa's where they grow all corn. Minnesota's right on top of it. And he said, I can't keep all them Southern Canadian states straight anyway. So whatever. And then he just like mumbled off and walked away. So
You know, and that's extinction in a nutshell.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, speaking of, I listened to your podcast with Caitlin the other day, and that was such an awesome view into the world of extension. Like, it was so perfect. Oh my gosh. Just the fact that, like, everyone relies on their network and you got to talk to everyone, and you know, you're texting your colleagues like, hey, the army worms are coming. Like, we do the same stuff in forestry. Like, look out for IPS. Like, here's your storm. Like, it's just, it was such a perfect view for anyone that maybe hadn't been in extension. This is what it is. It's basically always thinking on your feet and never having like a good schedule, because we don't get schedules, basically.
Yep. Which I think is actually a really good segue into kind of talking about your life over the last year. You have been, you work with invasive species very frequently, but that does sort of disrupt life in extension. It makes it so you can't schedule things very easily. And you've had two really interesting invasive species kind of pop up in your backyard. So one's Asian longhorn beetle, right? What was that like last summer, getting that email or phone call where they were like, oh, hey, by the way.
it was nuts, man, because it was the heat of COVID, right? So
right.
Basically every day at that point, it was the last week of May, I got the call. And so every day at that point, we had a family thing where I usually would get up super early in the F's, as my wife says. And then I would work till like, you know, 6:37, get the kids up. And then I would go back to work from like 8 to 11. And then I like checked out for the day. And like, there's a lot of days, you know, and then I would be dad. And there was a lot of days by like 2:30, the kids were in the pool outside and I was sitting there with the adult beverage, just like passing the day away, because whatever, no one's going anywhere.
Right.
So we'd like start to grill, whatever. And so it was a Friday afternoon and I got a call at 2:30 from Stephen Long, who's one of our leads in our regulatory division here at Clemson. And I remember thinking, this is weird for him to call me at 2:30 on a Friday, because I know he's got kids too. And then he told me that they found Asian longhorn beetle done by Charleston. And it was just like, whoa. It was just like, holy crap, we don't have anything ready. You know, and he said at the time, the press release is going to go out Monday. And, you know, my first thought was like, well, I don't have anything ready. I have to work all weekend, you know? And of course, that's basically what happened. Like, cause we had to, it's such a, you've got to have all your extension stuff ready when a press release of that magnitude goes out. Right. And right. ALB hadn't moved in a decade. You know, they found it, what, in Ohio in like 08 or so, or 10 or something like that. And it was one of those forest pests that, you know, we would talk about in the Southeast. We would talk about, hey, watch out for Asian longhorn beetle, but everyone's kind of like, meh, it's probably not going anywhere. All of a sudden, like, holy crap, it's here. So I spent the weekend writing fact sheets, getting blog posts ready, emailing people that we could. It was so like kind of secret at the time, because we were waiting for the official thing to go out, but like all the materials had to be like ready to hit the send button Monday at 1:00. We ended up getting another day because APHIS pushed back the release till Tuesday. So thank you. It was a good deal. So yeah, the minute that press release went out, boom, send, post, everything went up. And at that point, it's been just crazy ever since, you know? So we weren't traveling at that point either. And overnights were a no-go. So I was making a 4-hour trip to Charleston once a week, and I was doing it as a day trip. So I'd leave at like 4:30 in the morning. I'd get there by about 8:39-ish. I would spend, you know, till 1 or 2, usually about 1-ish, meetings, field visits, just, you know, training people. And like, awesome. Also, as an entomologist, freaking awesome. Like, holy cow, there's just beetles. You could just find beetles walking around. So much damage. And then that would get me home by like dinner time. And I did that every week from beginning of June through October. Then we could start staying overnight, and I started doing that occasionally. But yeah, it was nuts. And then just nobody, I guess coming up in grad school, nobody really tells you what it's like to start a program, right? Nothing, right? Because my appointment here is 100% extension. And when I got the job, they're like, yeah, we expect you to do some research to support your extension thing. So I'm like, all right, I'll do a couple of like pesticide trials or herbicide trials or something. All of a sudden, like, here we are with the biggest ALB infestation in North America. You've basically got 2 to 3 years while you've got high populations to get as much field data as you can, because they're going to start cutting trees and getting rid of it almost immediately. And so it's this mad rush, like, boom, grad student, boom, technician, get this started, get this started, get this started. And it was like all consuming. I don't know that I've recovered from it. I don't know that I will. But, you know, we've learned to manage it. So it was just a lot of stuff. It was cool.
I definitely remember last summer thinking about, I wanted to find out if there was a patron saint of extension so I could light a candle for you at their altar or something. Because I knew
it was a drink out or something.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, we could have poured a little bourbon out for you. Yeah. Or something. I knew it would have to be crazy. I mean, that's a bug that gets talked about all the time as this sort of like omega level pest that it just changes everything. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about why that is? Like, what is Asian longhorn beetle and why did it change your life so drastically?
Yeah, Asian longhorn beetle is a federally regulated invasive pest. It's originally from China, and it's a wood borer. So it can spend, generally 1 to even up to 10 years inside wood. The adults only live kind of a few months or few weeks, but the larvae feed first in the phloem. They don't need a lot of phloem, but then they go into the wood and they basically make Swiss cheese out of it. So they don't kill the tree outright, but they completely degrade the structure and you get breaking branches and stems all over. It's a real hazard and real danger. They really prefer maples. And of course, maples are one of those things that up north, it's more of a major forest component. It's not such a major forest component down here, but it's a big part of our swamps and wetlands. But everyone's got maple trees in the yard. It's a super common species that's in parks, yards, urban areas. And so you can imagine how uncool that would be if big chunks of it are just falling randomly to the ground, right? And it's moved in solid wood packing materials. So it probably got over here in, dunnage or pallets or something. So it's a big deal. And it's, when I say federally regulated, aphis descends like a swarm, when you have something like this. And they did. I mean, they set up, we got a field station. We still have weekly, meetings are biweekly now, but they were weekly meetings. There's so much to be coordinated. But the pest itself, because it spends most of its life cycle inside wood, it's easy to get moved around. It's very likely it came from the Ohio population in firewood. We've done some genetic analysis and it completely matches that population. So that means you've got technically three possibilities of how it got here. It could have come from Ohio. It could have come from the same place in China where the Ohio population came from, possible, but a little farther fetched because everything would have to line up. Or it could have come from Europe because they're all over Europe. But then that means the same population in China would have had to go to Europe and then would have had to come here, which is even more unlikely. I mean, at some point you look at the simplest explanation and it's firewood from Ohio. We're in a major tourist area down there. Ohio is one of the top 10 states from where people visit. We have those data. And I can just tell you, there are so many people that just carry firewood. It's so frustrating. And especially if you've got $250,000 mobile home, you're carrying like 20 bucks worth of firewood. Like, why do you need to do that? If you can afford that thing, just buy your firewood where you go. And anyway, get me on that soapbox. But
no, you get to make fun of Ohioans. This is yes. I absolutely do that on the show.
I'm convinced it came from firewood in Ohio. We'll never know, right? But simplest explanation is probably the most correct one. So, there's quarantines. We've got a few nurseries that grow hardwood trees down there, so you can't move any of that material outside of that quarantine zone. So the first big step was to figure out where is the edge of the infested area. We've got about a 76 square mile quarantine zone right now. You can do dendrochronology. So you can look at where those exit holes, the adult makes a big exit hole in the tree, and you can look at the tree rings and date when that beetle came out. So the infestation started at least in 2013. So it had been here 7 years before it was found. And we're talking, an inch and a half long black and white beetle. And wasn't reported. It was mostly in this one kind of golf course retirement type neighborhood. And, we'd all be in there, walk around. Of course, everyone's like, oh, what are y'all doing here? And we'd show them the beetle like, oh, we're looking for these. And they'd say, oh, yeah, the pool beetles. We see those at the pool all the time. And it's like, I remember saying, oh, sorry, how long have you seen these at the pool? I don't know, 2-3 years, right? And they were like, talk to each other. And I was just thinking, damn, really? Like, y'all know these things have been here. And it's frustrating. So for a while, I was kicking myself. Like, how could people not have known? But, it's one of those things, extension, you'll never reach everybody. And I think you just have to accept that or you'll go insane. And so then I was just like, well, whatever. Okay, fine. So anyway, it's here now. And so now, we've got billboards up, there's all sorts of advertisements and media to get people to report it. And it's like it's a crazy tornado of research extension and regulatory activity.
So how was it first reported then? Was it someone, an entomologist came to the pool?
Funny story, Jody. This lady that lived in that neighborhood took a picture. She phoned on her light and she sent it to her kid. And it just so happened that her kid was an entomologist at Texas A&M, who just so happened to have done his PhD at Cornell, where they have ALB up in New York. And he recognized it right away. He's like, Ma, you have got to call regulatory. DPI is our regulatory. He's like, you have got to call them stat. And she did. And of course, they went up there that day from the Charleston office. And it's a pretty easy confirmation, right? So think how lucky we got on that one, right? What if her kid had been, I don't know, just like had owned like a restaurant. He would have been like, hey, cool, Ma, delete. And then like moved on, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as entomologists, I assume all your relatives send you pictures of stuff mm-hmm. like that. And we, yep. we humor them. But like, you know, if this wasn't our job and someone sent me a picture of a bug, I'd be like, all right. It's, you know, like, if, yeah, seriously, why are you sending me this? So it was such a real, it was just a very, very serendipitous certain events that we even found the thing, or it could just still be crunching along, right?
No, it's neat that you found it after 7 years. I remember when Emerald Ash Borer came in, that was about a 10-year lag. And when it comes to these wood boring pests, it seems like the infestation starts and then there's like a 5 to 10 year lag usually before we find them. That's why spotted lanternfly was so weird, because it was only here for 2 or 3 years before we caught it.
Well, they're so cryptic, right? I mean, it's hard to spot a bug that lives under the bark of a tree. And then I assume the exit holes and stuff, just like EAB, they probably start towards the top of the tree, or do they take over the whole tree unlike EAB?
You know, it seems variable, and it kind of depends on, from what I have seen, it looks like they almost prefer the smoother bark versus the really rough corrugated type stuff. So if you've got a big tree, yeah, it's probably going to be higher. It doesn't mean it will only be higher. They can be all over the thing. But if you've got a smaller diameter tree, it could be anywhere out there. And, you know, even though that beetle is like an inch and a half long, black with white spots, it's actually really hard to see when it's up in the trees, because they don't move a whole lot. They're pretty lethargic. And the way the sun kind of goes through and puts little specks everywhere, it just like blends in with sun specks. They're really hard to see. And so I know they're out there, but even for like people that are looking all the time, they're kind of hard to see the adults. So it doesn't surprise me. And then, you know, because it doesn't kill those trees right away, we don't have rapid tree mortality. It's just like, oh, a branch is dying. And oh, here's, you know, the top dying. But if we're being honest, most of the maples this far south, they all look kind of garbagey, because it's just at the very kind of southern edge of red maple's climatic range. And there's some other hosts that'll hit, sycamore, cottonwood, willow, that type of thing. But it's, you know, 98% maple species are what it prefers. That's what we're seeing down here. Like of all the trees, 98% are maples. And then you've got 2% other elms in there. So for someone to notice a kind of crappy looking maple tree, meh, all right. Like I can show you one of those like along anywhere in this part of the world. So it didn't, nothing really stands out. And then all of a sudden, then you start seeing the damage, seeing the holes and seeing like big chunks fall off. Like, wow, like the top just fell out of this tree. That's a little weird. And that's when it kind of is a little more easy to see what's up.
I did appreciate you pointing out the fact that this is something that could confront a lot of the urban and street trees, those right-of-way trees, because I want to put it in the chat and I'll put it in our show notes. There's this map of sort of the projected range of where ALB will be the biggest issue. I think the red is the more problematic area. The blue is the least problematic area. And it sort of shows Kentucky on down to Florida as this like, it's probably not going to be a very big deal, because all the trees are different in the woods down there than when you compare it to the New England states and where Mike is. And I think that's a bit misleading, because there's a lot of maple trees that people like. I could go around Lexington and if it's not an ash that's been saved, it's probably a maple that's planted in front of somebody's house. So they're extremely popular trees.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, when foresters heard about this, they were like, meh, whatever. Maple's like 2% of our forest canopy. So it's not a, there's very little economic value on maple, right? It's strictly in an economic forestry product sense, very little. So if, in general, the forestry crowd was like, meh, whatever. You know, much more concerned with the pine beetle or something like that. But yeah, I mean, this map is misleading, because it's the forest types in the natural areas. And if you were to actually have a good map of urban tree canopies, it would be bad everywhere, right? Maples mm-hmm. are such a common, ubiquitous, there's such a great urban tree. That's why, you know, they have them on every street. So it's a much different thing. And that's something we're trying to work out a little bit is we don't have good urban tree data from the deep south. I know there's that iTree program that the Forest Service has done, which is pretty good up north, but there's just not a lot of good stuff in the south. So it's a challenge. It's really starting from ground zero in a lot of respects. You know, we've got a brand new climate. So we're kind of trying to still figure out, well, is it just 1 year or, you know, there is something that looked like it might be less than a year in some cases. I know lab studies have said they can get them to rip through in 8 to 10 months. There's a model out there that showed that a generation in this climate could take anywhere from like 7 to 12 months. So if you're talking a 7 month generation, this is it's a whole new ballgame, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if we get a really warm year where it stays warm a long time, you could have some of those early eggs that were deposited, even coming out as adults, still that calendar year. So we're doing, you know, I've got a grad student doing that now. And just, there's just a lot of stuff we just don't know. And again, you only get a couple, 3 years and then all the trees are gone and your beetle populations are super low. And then your field stuff's kind of tough to do at that point.
So that makes me think about the population that was in New York. The control there was, you know, it's only infesting basically urban trees. We're going to cut down every susceptible tree within a 2 mile radius. And if you kill all the hosts, they don't fly that far. We can eliminate it. Ohio is a little bit different because they've got maples in the landscape. So they're cutting down trees. They're applying pesticides to some susceptible trees, but it's going to be a lot harder because it's a bigger infestation and there's just maples everywhere. What are the control strategies that they're thinking about using? Because it sounds like down where you're at, it is going to be mostly urban trees similar to like New York. Is it just cut everything down? What's the control strategy and how does that relate to like what has been done in other places?
Yeah, good question, Mike. So that's the other layer to this onion is the environment down here is quite different than in the other infested places. We've got a where it is established is a combination of neighborhoods, strip molly type areas, and swamps, like flat out swamps. And remember, we don't freeze down here. So you've got standing water practically year round. And this is where you get a lot of these maples. So in the areas where you can where they can get the equipment, they're doing the remove, cry, and chip and all the same thing, right? Side note, the worst part about extension is having to tell a homeowner that their tree is going to get cut down because I don't like it when people cry. Like after you tell them something and they like cry, like, you know, oh, my late wife planted that tree. It's like, oh God, okay, I'm sorry. That's like the worst part of the job. Don't like that part. And it's part of it that you have to do. So a lot of the urban residential trees are getting ground and chipped just like everything else. But like I said, we've got a lot of flat out swamps that are anywhere from like ankle to thigh high water a lot of the year. And, you know, we're looking at some different tactics. One benefit we have is things decompose so quickly down here. We've got a grad student, I'm working with Kelly Oten at NC State. We've got a grad student who's looking at, can you just cut the tree down and let nature decompose it faster than ALB will come out? Just cut it down. So we're testing whether we can just cut it down, leave it on the ground, cut it down, and then buck it up into 4 foot chunks. And 4 feet is your official designation for firewood. Firewood pieces officially are 4 feet or less. And then we've also done hack and squirt where you just kill the tree, you know, basically inject herbicide into the side of the tree and leave it standing. So you'll leave a dead snag. The thought is, you know, we know that ALB, once those larvae in the wood get to a certain point, if the conditions become unfavorable, they can just stop being a larva and pupate, but they have to get past a certain point, right? So it's almost like if situation and hit this point and everything's still cool, they'll just keep eating as growing as a larva and then become a bigger adult. But if they get to that one point and they're, I guess, mature enough and all of a sudden the tree starts drying out, they'll just be like, peace out, and they pupate. And then they'll just be a little smaller adult. So we're trying these things. We set up her study in last May where we dropped a bunch of trees, left some on the ground, cut some up, left some standing. And super encouraging, we're actually going tomorrow I leave because we got her second quarterly harvest. But even after 3 months, the trees on the ground were loaded with fungus, like mushrooms growing out of them, falling apart. And so, you know, we're super optimistic that this is going to be possible because there's no way you're getting any equipment into those areas, not without completely destroying it. Maintaining the ecology of the system is part of APHIS's mission. So they're not going to take, you know, swamp monster in there and just like mow everything down. Like, you know, what is it? I can't think of that movie. The Thneeds? What is it? You know, the sweater things in Dr. Seuss? Anita Thneed?
Lorax.
Gosh, thank you. Yeah, where they come and just mow everything down with their crazy machines. Like, we can't do that, right? But that said, pretty optimistic. We'll know more after this week. So those are some of the new things we're testing. That to me is one of my most, I guess, satisfying projects, because if this works, think of the time and money we're going to save all of us, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, your tax dollars are paying for part of this stuff. We can make that removal process more efficient. That's just going to be awesome. So to be continued. But yeah, we got to come up with something else in those swampy areas, because I don't know what else we'll do. Mm-hmm. So
that is very exciting. This is one of those things that makes me the most scared about ALB, is the confrontation that you were talking about between tree owners and the need to get rid of an invasive species. I don't know if you've met Joe Boggs at Ohio State.
I've met Joe.
Okay. So I thought you probably had crossed paths at least at this point, but he tells these, I mean, to me, like absolutely horrifying extinction stories about people like almost chaining themselves to trees to stop people from coming in to help eradicate this beetle. And he just tries to drill into their head like, hey, you're helping potentially the worst invasive species we could ever have in our state try and triumph. Like, it'll be super bad everywhere if when this beetle escapes, if it gets out. I've listened to him talk and seen from afar the things in Ohio. And yeah, it's always sort of terrified me. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to light a candle for you at some sort of altar.
Yeah.
I know people they love their trees. They're not going to want to get rid of them.
They do. And, you know, and I will say that the way everything went down in Ohio was not optimal from a messaging standpoint. And anyone that was in that program will tell you they did not come at it the right way. They were a little more probably calloused and heartless than they should have been. Mostly the feds on that side did not do great. And it was just, the timing wasn't good. And I don't think, they just didn't have their messaging right. It was something like this where you're flat out coming and taking people's stuff. You got to have a unified, perfectly coordinated message between the feds and the state and everyone, so that there's like no question, you know, there's not one versus the other. Like, and then that's, so we worked really hard to make sure everyone was like right in step with each other to handle all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's the worst. And like, oh, I feel so bad telling some of those people, I'm sorry, we have to, like, these are going to go. And you could just see the one lady just like ran inside crying. It's just like, oh my God, horrible person. But like, you got to do it, right?
Yep.
Otherwise, the devastation could be really, really bad. And like, I always thought of it like, well, I would rather have someone run away crying and sad because they have to take their tree versus some person get hit with a falling branch, like some kid in the park get a branch fall on.
After you start talking, I remember sending you an email June of 2020, because you had said something like, I'll likely be giving a lot of my attention to ALB stuff in the near, maybe distant future. And it said, it's exciting, but it also sucks. And then we had a little conversation with some of the people from ESA about, yeah, that might be a good motto for entomologists, right? What makes it exciting also makes it suck. And
yeah,
it's probably similar to the other possibly invasive Joro spider, which we're excited to talk to you about, because it's one of those things, again, communication. As soon as someone ran into my office asking about a killer spider, I was like, wait a second, I got to call David Goyle because I think I saw one on his hand.
Yeah. Yeah. So I still live in Georgia. We only live, Clemson's just kind of over the border. So we still live in Georgia from when I worked at UGA for all those years. So we live in outside of Athens. And, you know, for a number of years, there's been this non-native spider, the Joro spider. It's a big orb weaver, you know, and I think you guys saw pictures, like it's, the body is at least an inch long. And with the leg spread, it's like 3 inches long. I mean, it's a massive thing. And if working with the public has taught me anything, it's that big spiders, they're not cool for a lot of people, right? Everyone gets a little bit twitchy when you say, hey, there's a big new spider coming near you. Like, ah, like everyone gets out the flamethrowers basically. But So this thing was first found in 2014 in just a few miles up the road from where I live, about Braselton, Georgia, which is just like a half hour north of Atlanta, up 85. Highly suspected it came in on a shipping container. It's originally from Korea, China, Japan. And it had sort of, populations had sort of simmered here in North Georgia for a few years, right? I had never seen one until this year. We've been in this house for 5 years now, since 2016. So I knew these things were around. I'd never seen one. And all of a sudden this year, they were everywhere, all over the property, dozens of them. And they are as big and colorful as advertised. And the webs are friggin' massive. Like, they can stretch 10, 12 feet between trees. I've got a row of little trees I planted on the side. They're about 6, 8 feet tall now. And I was telling Jody, the webs stretch from tree to tree. You know, so I don't know if they, you know, they lay an anchor thread down and then they just walk all the way down and then walk up the next one and boom, they've got their anchor. So they've got these huge webs. And again, big yellow spiders. So getting back though to the invasive thing. So I guess invasive ecology 101. So there's different categories for things that are not from here. So it all starts with what's a native species, right? A native species is something that is from here. And this is where you'll get in some debates. I look at what is here. It's a continent, right? If something is from North America, it's native North America. I don't agree that if something is normally from Mexico and then it just sort of rides across a log across the Rio Grande River and gets to Texas, it's not invaded. That's just probably more or less natural movement, right? Or some beetle in Canada that just walks across into Minnesota, that's not all of a sudden invasive species because it's like 30 feet over there, the population, right? So for me, I look at a continental scale because that, to me, is, I think, what the most appropriate. So you've got your native stuff.
Can I?
And then you've got, what's that,
Mike? Interrupt you for a second and ask you about that?
Yeah.
Because I see things like Western conifer seed bug here that is native to North America, but was restricted to west of the Rockies until the 50s. When, you know, we put some interstates through in cars and probably through human transport got into the east and now it's a major pest here. So, like, would you still consider that native, even though it was restricted in range to a different kind of ecotone or ecological area within the continent that's very different from where it's found and being a problem now?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. And walnut twig beetle and thousand canker's disease is the same type of thing, right? That was normally just down in the southwest. And then all of a sudden it got transported up to Tennessee and all the eastern things. So, that's like a native invasive, right? Because it's native to the continent, but it also was geographically separated from everything, right? You've got the Great Plains, which serves as a very nice geographic boundary to a lot of western and eastern forest pests, honestly, right? Because to get across the Great Plains, you're probably not going to tree hop unless you're really, really, really good about it, because there's like four trees. So you got to, like, it's generally, if it's going to cross from east to west, it's going to be on some sort of human transport. And of course, human media transport is a huge issue in all the invasive movement of everything, really. That is one where I would probably say, I would still say it's native, but it's in a new range or kind of invasive in a new range. It's tricky with that terminology because there's so many sort of gray areas. And that to me is a real gray area.
Well, and that, not to get us too far off track before you finish, like, what is an invasive? That messes with like what APHIS can do and what federal agencies can do, because it's all within the United States. You know, they can't necessarily deal with something that is native to California, but now invasive in Pennsylvania or something.
Yeah, then correct? it gets left up to the states, right? And you've got this mosaic of different state responses to different things, which usually doesn't work, because if it's going to work, you would need all of the states in that new area to basically have the same regulations. Firewood's a classic case. Some states have firewood regulations where you cannot bring it in. Others are just sort of like, meh. Others have regulations. They're just not enforced. When you start going to state-by-state regulations for pests that don't adhere to socio-political boundaries, it's really tricky because, you know, they don't care where the border of the state is. They're just like, oh, there's a tree I like, and boom, there they are. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tricky. Did I successfully talk around that point enough to quasi answer it without being?
Yeah, no, I just I'm dealing with a lot of Western conifer seed bugs now because they're coming into people's homes with fall. Not to derail you too far, but that I mean, all of these questions probably have some nuance to them. So I just wanted to ask you about that that part. So
yeah, no, that's tricky. And that's a really good point. Like from a regulatory perspective, I can't do anything about that. APHIS can't, because it's all within the country boundaries, right? So APHIS is just concerned with like stuff coming in from other countries. So you've got native, whether it's native or native invasive. And then you've got these, anything that comes in that is not from here, from this continent. And these are either non-native, they're called exotic, they're called alien. I use the term non-native a lot. That just means it's something that's not from here. Just because something arrives in this country, pestilized, that's not from here, does not make it invasive automatically. So invasive is like a sliver of that pie. I think of the worst of the worst. These are the ones that are going to have, you know, exploding populations, huge ecological, economic impacts, displacing native species. That is an invasive species. Give you an example here. I wrote a few down. There's lots of non-native bark beetles and ambrosia beetles here in the U.S. Hypothenemus crudier, Hypothenemus californicus, Ambrosiodemus rubicalis, Cacotrypes distinctus. You've probably never heard of any of those. They're non-native, but they've been here for decades and they haven't done anything. So not invasive. The invasive ones are like the red bay ambrosia beetle that's spreading laurel wilt and killing, you know, Lauraceae everywhere. Emerald ash borer, right? Clearly invasive, leaving a wake of destruction. So there's a big difference between what's just non-native and what's invasive. And then even, you know, going farther with that, just because something gets here, that's not really the most important part of the whole process. The important thing is, does it establish? Because who cares if some new bug comes here and then doesn't survive the winter? Like, all right, fix itself, problem solved, right? But it's the ones that establish, that's where our problem is. So really, you know, we've got these non-native species, some of which establish, some of which become invasive. It's a pretty thin sliver of how much is actually gets to this continent every day, which would probably shock a lot of people how many introductions we really have every day. It's like a lot. Anyway, that being said, the Joro spider is clearly non-native. The kicker is, you know, is it invasive? Well, we don't have any data that shows it's invasive other than populations have exploded. Anyone that's done invasive species work, this is very clearly acting like an invasive species growth-wise, but we don't have any data yet to be able to call it an invasive species. So I reluctantly will not call it an invasive species, even though I firmly believe it is. That's my official position on that.
I appreciate all this nuance. I think it's interesting, particularly when we're talking about a predator versus, I know in my experience, a lot of invasive species boil down to plant pests. But in the last couple of years, I've had to hear about this Joro spider now. I've also been dealing a lot with Asian longhorned tick in this state. People are very concerned about it. So it's a parasitic invasive species, which is kind of weird. It just seems like we're opening the door up. Like it's not just plant pests anymore. They can all come over.
It'd be easy to not have any invasive species. You just have to stop importing stuff.
Right.
Which clearly is not going to happen. So
we could make more supply chain issues. Oh, that's the official arthropod policy. Dr. David Boyle advocating for
the stop importing.
Stop importing. Like, what's the problem?
And that's, you know, that's stuff that people need to realize, that we are always going to have these issues as long as we like the comforts that we like. We being the population of this country, we're always going to be importing stuff. We're just not going to get around that. So we have to deal with this stuff.
Yeah, it's always awkward trying to talk to people when they're like, for ESA, I did the virtual path this year, and I was part of a symposium that was called Advancing Public Understanding of Local Invasives or Nuisance Insects. I was only on the on demand. So I talked about how I become a generalist, because it's whatever comes up in extension is what I got to work on. Matt Bertone talked about the Asian giant hornet and how, and mass hysteria. And so when I heard about the Joro spider, I was like, ooh, this is the next quotes murder hornet. And I immediately reached out to you. Yeah. And what was your response?
It's not invasive yet. Is that what I said? I don't know. What did I say?
You said it is. Oh. Gonna be the next.
You must have caught pessimistic.
We can cut that out if you don't like it. No,
that's fine. And that's the thing. It's a big, and I'm also, I'll say, I'm so glad I don't have to deal with Hymenopterans, like the hornet thing. I'm glad that one like passed me over. We had a guy that just retired that took all that. I was like, oh, I don't need any of that.
Well, because whether it's invasive or not, it's going to be a mass hysteria. Like when people start getting them in their yard, similar to what you're seeing in your yard this year, what is their reaction? Where are they going to post that? Who are they going to call? Where's it going to go? And so on.
What will the New York Times call it?
Oh, there's so much media over this thing. And, you know, I'm a little torn. I like that the media picked it up because I do want to encourage people to report it. And we've got some stuff we're trying to get started for next year to really get good reporting on it. But, you know, things get sensationalized so fast. It snowballs into this life of its own. And like, once it goes, as a professional and expert, it's really tough to rein it in. Like, well, that's gone now. And like, it's the murder hornet or like baby taken spider, whatever it's going to be, right?
Baby taken spider. Know, you heard it here first.
And like, you know, there's one scientist that even was sort of saying, these things are good. They eat Marmorated stink bugs. And I just, I cringed when I heard that. I'm like, I don't think you can say they're good or bad yet. But just the fact that they've all of a sudden exploded in populations, I don't know. I just have a problem with people saying something is good when we don't know if it's good yet. Also, when like Spidey Sense and Gut says this is probably not good. You know, there's been some anecdotal reports of declines in the yellow garden spider populations because of this, which completely makes sense, right? They're out at the same time, that late summer thing. Anecdotally, that's what I saw. I only saw like one yellow garden spider on our property this year, and usually we've got a bunch of them. And then Joros are everywhere. And so I just have a problem when scientists are saying, we should welcome these in. They're predators. I'm like, welcome them in. I mean, they're here now, but.
Yeah, cane toads are predators too.
Yeah. Oh my God, great. I wish I would have thought of that. Perfect retort.
So you mentioned Argyope, the yellow garden spiders that many people at least are going to be familiar with. Because like you said, they're out every fall. They're not quite as big as Joro spiders. People seem to like them. They generally know that they're not, you know, medically important and not going to bite and whatnot. What I didn't realize before doing a little bit of research for this is that we actually have a native golden orb weaver that gets, you know, up into the Carolinas, even up as far as North Carolina and like Southern Virginia. It's in the same genus, Trichonephila. It's the golden silk orb weaver, Trichonephila clavipes. And it gets down into like Central and South America as well. Do you see the native species often? Are people familiar with that? Is it similar in size and in shape or color to the Joro spiders? Like, are people familiar with it enough to be like, oh, the Joro spider is similar? Or do we think the Joro spider is going to outcompete it? What is the interaction given we have this native species? Like, how does that influence what's going on?
Yeah, that's a good one. So yeah, they call it the banana spider down here. It's super common in the low country, which is like the coastal plain towards the coast. I cannot tell you how many webs I walked into doing Asian longhorn beetle work. It's like the worst thing in the field work is to walk into a big web with no hair, because like you just feel everything on your scalp, right? Most people probably aren't going to be able to tell apart. The Joros are yet in a place where the banana spiders are. The Joros aren't quite that far south in the state. Banana spiders are getting up in the middle of the state and called the Midlands, kind of like that Columbia, Augusta, Columbia, Charlotte line. Bananas, and again, that's the clavipes. That's why I'm calling the banana spiders, right? Our native. The banana spiders have what looks like they're fuzzy leg warmers. They're like super fuzzy, like they're wearing those 80s leg warmers, right? So that's how I describe them to people. They've got like bottle brushes on there. Joros don't have quite that much. The pattern on the back is a little different. Size-wise, they're about the same. Webs look about the same. They're just massive with some like golden anchor strands or like a golden color. And they're super, super strong. I was telling this to Jody. Like I could grab that golden strand of the Joro that's between our two young trees. And I would pull that thing and the trees would bow over before the strand actually broke. It's incredibly strong for spider web, like string almost. And I don't think clavipes really gets up high enough into Georgia yet. I just don't think those two have met in the wild yet. So who knows? They're super similar in every other way, though. Size, color, shape, sort of web construction. They've got the little tiny male that like hang out trying to get in there to mate before they get eaten. We just don't know yet what's going to happen when they get together. And I highly doubt most people are going to be able to tell them apart. They're big yellow spiders. Maybe some will. I mean, to me, the pattern is really different. And, you know, there's already like Joro spider appreciation Twitter accounts and web pages. And
do we know why Joros are exploding? Like, if they escaped, I don't know, parasitism or predation. And then I wonder if any of the native predators and parasitoids that hit the banana spiders are going to jump onto them after a couple of years, maybe give a little bit of control.
Yeah, no idea. We don't know any of this stuff yet. You know, and so there's only been one paper published on these things from the US, and that was at Hoback et al. One that basically documented, here's where it is, here's what it is. They did some genetics and showed that it was either from China or Japan, probably not Korea or Taiwan. That's all. I mean, we don't know anything else about Joros other than crowdsourced incidences of where they are. We know nothing about the ecology here. We know nothing about what they eat. We know nothing about their impacts. Yeah, so we don't know. So, you know, I've been talking to several folks around here, and I'm not an arachnologist. So this is, a lot of this is new to me. I'm trying to make some new connections with people that are into this, because if I'm being honest, I don't have time for this. Like, I just don't have time for another thing like this. We need to know what's going on with this thing. So we're trying to get a group together to, at the very least, try to document the spread rate and where it's gone. And we were going to, you know, I talked to Matt Bertone yesterday. It was one of them I talked to. And we're going to try to make a big public push next summer to get as many people as we can to report these things. Where are they? You know, this is the first year that we've found them in Tennessee and North Carolina. Before it was just Georgia and South Carolina. So they're two new states now. So we want to get a really good push, show us where they are. And then, you know, maybe we'll see if we can get some, try to figure out their impact. I think you can probably, you know, they tend to leave carcasses hanging in their web for a while and then they'll clean it out. But I would think anyone that's taken a, you know, basic entomology taxonomy course could probably sift through the carcasses and at least get stuff to family, you know, figure out what they're eating. We have connected with some people that have just found like a Joro spider kind of around them somewhere. They're going to start doing surveys next year as far as like looking at all the spiders. Cause I think the important thing for these is going to be documenting, well, what happens with the spider populations that were there? And then as the Joros move in, then what happens? My hunch is you're going to see declines in everything else except Joros. Like that's my hunch, but we don't have any data, right? So at this point, we're trying to establish those collaborations with people that are like out on the edge that haven't been inundated yet, because it seems pretty clear that it's coming. Mm-hmm. Now, how fast? Who knows? This genus is known for ballooning, and apparently they're pretty good ballooners, and that's where the young will send up some silk off their back end and just catch the wind and fly. But then looking at iNaturalist, you know, it certainly looks like a lot of the sightings are along interstates, right? So 85 South, 85 North, 75 North, 75 South. So my hunch is these things are probably pretty good just hitchhikers, because they'll put webs on structures just as readily as they'll put them on a tree. So y'all are probably going to get it at some point. So it's not temperature limited. You know, if you look at the native range, it's going to be probably comfortable even all the way up in Southern Canada. So this is probably coming.
And you said that they were very messy, and this is why you don't like having them around.
Yeah, personally. I mean, the webs are huge. We got kids and a dog. I just don't want them. Nobody wants to deal with that as a parent. Like, so I just tend to get them out of there and got our like throughways where everyone runs outside. The stuff in the woods, whatever, do your thing. But like, you know, where the balls are getting thrown and all that stuff, I clear them out of there.
I just did a quick YouTube search while you were talking a moment ago about like what maybe people are saying on there, because I know you can find it on Twitter and stuff, but I also like seeing what people are making videos about on these different invasive species. There's one really good one. It's called Redneck 101, Hunting the Joro Spider with an Air Rifle. I think that you could probably team up with that fella. There's another guy using black powder pistols to try and destroy them. There's a lot of how do I kill them is what I'm trying to say. One guy has invented, it looks like he took a clasper, like a thing that you use to pick up stuff you've dropped, and he's glued boards onto the clasping pieces so you can squish them. I thought that was pretty inventive. And then there's the obligate. I can't tell if Coyote Peterson actually met a Joro spider or if he's talking about a different spider, but that's the one with 17 million views. So
as someone said, they got bit by it. Cause I've heard that the bite is like pretty tame.
That's I don't see a lot of people talking about being bit. There's like, it's here to stay. Its venom's not dangerous. Why are there so many here? How did it get here? And then the various and sundry, this is how I destroy them on my property.
Yeah. It's just a matter of time before someone burns their house That's really what I'm just looking at, is mm-hmm. like someone's going to try to light on fire and catch their siding on fire. And like, it's just a matter of time. So you're also, as long as we preserve that for posterity, that will happen at some point. If anyone else is listening, don't burn webs. You don't need to do that.
That's generally a good rule, is don't destroy it with fire, actually.
Right. And especially anything attached to your house. It's probably a good rule to not do that. So,
or at a gas station. I read a story about a guy that tried to burn a spider at a gas pump.
This is natural selection. It's just like a fascinating thing. Like, because I knew the Joros were around, but I didn't really care because they're spiders and they weren't really doing anything. And all of a sudden this year, just by default, that falls in my wheelhouse at Clemson because I'm the invasive species guy. And it's like, well, okay. So I've had to do this crash course on them, and like, you know, they're around here. So it's pretty easy to get footage and stuff from the news and all that. But, and it's going to be tough. We've said before that we need more research on these things. Well, that's not free. So it's this tricky balance where it seems to be pretty invasive, but it's not, there's not been any economic impacts demonstrated yet. So who's going to pay for it, right? It becomes really hard if there's not a big economic impact on it to get money, to get a student, to get someone to do this. So it's, you know, in those early stages for stuff like this, it's almost like you're kind of dependent on undergrad projects and that type of thing. And that's just not a lot of what I do. So
that's like the big problem with these early invasives, when you're not quite sure if they're invasive. Imagine the first year or two that we knew spotted lanternfly were here, like, oh, we don't know if it's quite invasive. We don't want to spend the $30 or $50 million it's going to take to eradicate it. Now it's doing billions of dollars of damage. Like, nobody wants to spend tens of millions of dollars up front, but when these things establish, and in, you know, not every invasive, the Joro probably won't cause $1 billion of damage. Not every invasive will do that, but like you said, it's really hard to get money up front when we don't know what's going to happen, but that's when we need to spend the money because it's the cheapest.
Yeah. And it's a bigger chunk, but you got to napalm that thing from the get-go if you want to, you know, snuff it out. And like you said, Mike, you don't know, like, what if we just spent $30 million trying to get rid of Hypothetamus crudier? Knowing that now, I've been like, what a waste. But like, where it could have been EAB, in which case that $30 million would have been the best money spent, right? So yeah, it's tricky. And I can appreciate the agencies who have to make these decisions, and but it's just, it's hard. That's why we focus so much on prevention, right? Keeping stuff out of here and having all those wood products properly treated and all the inspections that go on by APHIS and CBP and all that. I mean, that's really where it all starts.
I guess you describe your position as forest health. Is that mm-hmm. safe to say?
Yeah.
We had Jess Hartshorn on this spring, and, you know, talking to her about what does forest health mean and kind of this all encompassing, it's, you know, it's not just wood boring beetles and whatnot. Do you see Joro spider like getting out into the forest and causing impacts like in the woods, or is it going to be more of like a urban suburban pest in people's yards?
Yeah, probably not. Jess is awesome, by the way. We work together on tons of stuff down here, so it's been really cool coming in. We started on the same day a few years ago, so it was nice to come in with a friend. You know, I don't think this is going to be a forest pest per se. I think it's likely that they'll be able to demonstrate that there's some impacts on pollinators because they fly, and that's what webs catch, right? Is that flying stuff. But as far as like an actual forest pest, this is even more urban pests. It's probably more of a nuisance thing, you know, because people don't like them and they don't want them on their property and they don't want their pets in them and whatever. But they're not dangerous to pets. They're not dangerous to humans, but they're a nuisance. So that's where I see these fall. These are, you know, they're going to get in the woods, and like the banana spiders, those are all over the woods. Nobody really cares about them. They're just kind of there. And you know, if you go in the woods, you got to keep your eye open because you got webs all over the place.
Well, David, we don't mean to turn you into a prophet of doom for invasive species or anything. I know that that's a big part of your job. I know it's a big part of extension life in general, but I thought maybe we could offer you an opportunity to talk about any other cool projects that you got going on that are maybe promoting health in a different way of the forest, or maybe like a happier note we could end on for you here today.
You know, nobody ever asked me for a happy note. I'm really optimistic about some of our ALB research. Well, it's becoming a bigger part of what I do, but I think some of the stuff we're figuring out with ALB research is going to be really impactful. And that's really, you know, whether it's happy or not, if it makes an impact, I think that's kind of the important things for me. And I'm really excited about the different management methods we're looking at. I'm excited about the phenology data we're collecting, because we're going to be able to update that whole phenology map You know, and like I told, you know, Lena and Meredith, who are my students doing some of that stuff, their work is probably not going to help with this infestation, but their stuff is going to help for the next one. And there will be a next one, right? So we'll be better prepared to know life cycle and how, you know, fast it goes and all that type of thing. Abby's stuff, who's the student with Kelly and I, her stuff is going to be used now. So that's exciting too, knowing we've got some stuff that's going to feed into the future, some that's going to work right now. That to me is really exciting. So it's good, you know, it's good to have a chance to do things that will have a legitimate impact. You know, there's nice to know science and there's need to know science. And I feel really good in that what we're doing is very much need to know, because it's going to get directly incorporated into some of the management stuff we do. I guess the thing we didn't talk about is I do a lot of cal repair work too on the invasive plant side. And I'm sure Jess probably talked about that. If I remember, I think I listened to that one. That's a huge one too. You know, we, South Carolina, outlawed Bradford pear sales starting October 1, 2024. And that was a frost storm, if I might say too, like, cause you know, there's such common trees down here. And I was like, take them at Bradford pear. It's like, tree police are not going to come cut your tree down. Like, keep the one you want. It's a bad idea, but you can keep it. You just can't buy new ones. Right. So we've started a tree replacement program, the Bradford Pear Bounty. And this was done a couple of years before I even started. I borrowed it from the city of Fayetteville, Arkansas, and Missouri invasive plant folks. So we tell people if they cut their Bradford pear tree down and take a selfie with it, right? Like you just made a hunting kill, you bring that in, we'll show it to us, we'll give you a free native replacement tree. So it's a way to try to get people to get rid of Bradford pears in their yard, increase the diversity of the urban canopy. And then we can teach them about invasive species. And a lot of people don't make the connection that the Bradford pear in their yard is what contributes to all the cal repair that's everywhere, you know, that makes the roadsides white every spring, you know, and they're all over the place. And you know, there's a direct link there, right? Because the seeds from that Bradford pear get eaten by birds and crapped out over there. And then you got calories growing everywhere. So it's been a really good thing to teach people about the importance of planting native stuff.
So some people like all that white on the side of the road. So explain why we don't like that. But are they also called ornamental pear? So when people talk about ornamental pear, is that what they're talking about?
Yeah, they're basically flowering pears, pyrus, that does not produce an edible fruit. I mean, critters eat it and stuff, but so the species is Pyrus caloriana. The cultivar is Bradford. That was the main one. That was that one that looks like a white lollipop every spring. There's been a whole bunch of cultivars developed since, Cleveland Select, Aristocrat, blah, blah, blah. So let's start with Bradford, why we don't like it. It's a pretty tree, I'll give you that. But the minute it's got a really horrible branch structure, it's like every branch just goes straight up off the stem, right? So if it rains hard, if it ices, if it snows, if you look at it funny, branches just break off. And so it causes all sorts of cleanup. And, you know, for a homeowner who's got one, okay, whatever. But when you've got municipalities that have these planted in the medians everywhere, one storm can be tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage just cleaning up broken trees, right, from this particular species. And so they were marketed back in the 60s as thornless, sterile, they're all pest resistant. That one cultivar, Bradford, is thornless, but the minute it goes feral, thorns, it's got these crazy thorns on it, maybe 2-3 inches long. And the kicker is it's only sterile if pollen from another Bradford pear tries to pollinate it, so self-incompatible. Because they're all grafted, that means that if a shoot grows up off the roots, that's not Bradford. And if that shoot flowers, it can then pollinate the Bradford that's right on, that's growing on top of it. So you can have the same organism, which is technically two different genotypes pollinating each other. Long story short, every Pyrus caloriana now is making fertile fruit, because there's so much pollen everywhere. And so these get out and they're your classic invasive plant species. They crowd out all the natives. They're super thorny. People that are trying to get them off their property, they're really bad at invading old fields. And now we're seeing them creep into pine forests too, which is a big deal down here. Super thorny. So they pop tires all the time. So it costs landowners a lot of time and money to like replace their tires. Nothing eats them. As far as, you know, pests, very few things, I should say. So there's no bird food, right? And birds need, what they say, a clutch of chickadees, or not chickadees, I don't know, some clutch of little birds takes like several thousand caterpillars every spring just to raise that those birds up. So everywhere you've got a calorie pear, Bradford pear, it's like a food desert to a bird. There's really no good redeeming qualities of them other than they photosynthesize and they're pretty for a week, but they have a really pungent odor.
I was about to ask, can you talk about the smell? Yeah.
Pungent is a good way to describe it.
I've heard it described as rotten peanut butter, old sweat socks, semen. Like a lot of people call them like the sex tree because it smells like sex. And like, it's just, oh, and rotten fish. That's another one. Like it's tough to describe, but once you've stood in a grove and taking a good whiff in, like you'll never forget it.
I had one when we moved into our house that we have now, and my husband used to open the window and I was like, what is that smell? And he was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I was like, it smells like a cat came in and peed in our house. I don't have a cat. I don't know what that smells like, but that's what I feel like it smells like. And I could not figure it out.
Yeah.
Maybe Jonathan figured it out for me, but that tree in a storm, the middle blew right out. And it was like,
yeah.
I'll have to send you a picture. It was terrible. Oh, and then after I heard you talk, I was like, I know what that is. I hate it too.
Yeah.
Trade in all your trees.
It's gross. The sad thing is there's so many great natives that you can plant instead. You know, down here, we've obviously got a lot more choices than you do as you go farther north than you are, you know, you've got a few less options, but down here in like South Carolina and Georgia, there are so many native trees. Like you want flowers? Here's a handful of flowering spring trees. You want that pretty red foliage in the fall? Here's a handful of those. Like we have all these native substitutes that people just don't use, largely because the general public doesn't know. You know, neighborhoods get put in. There's just like a contract. So they just get 100 of the same thing and just stab them in the ground, right? Anyway, so all that work has been pretty fulfilling because we're working on trying to develop a good IPM plan. This is where some of those herbicide trials are coming in, just like what herbicide works at different sizes of tree, right? If you've got like a 6-footer, can you use a foliar or do you need to hack and squirt? So just trying to figure that out. And my goal is, you know, within a couple of years to have a full IPM plan for this thing that you can give people, like, that's almost like a flow chart, right? Are your trees in an old field or in the forest? If they're in an old field, how big are they? Well, then if that's the case, you've got these options, right? And fire doesn't work. Fire top kills it, but you know, you're going to get anywhere from 2 to 12 resprouts coming off that thing after a fire goes over it. I think there's a good IPM plan that incorporates fire because I think you burn, you know, we do a lot of prescribed fire down here too in both fields and forests and all that. I think if you burn that sucker and then you come back and let the resprouts get a couple feet high, they're perfect for herbicide and you can just nuke them and be done with it in 1 year. So that's kind of what we're going for, is to get something like that developed. And that's kind of a feel good thing. A lot of work still to do, but again, trying to make stuff that people will use is kind of the goal.
Point of extension.
That whole point of extension. That's right.
I think that's a really interesting sort of loop back to your first appearance on the show, because I remember you talking about joining extension and remember you saying that you were sort of like, I don't know about all this extension stuff. And it seems like you've really bought in hard to the mission, and it just warms my heart to hear and see.
Yeah, no, it's good. I guess you just need to be able to talk nonstop, which is not hard for me, I'm afraid. But
where can they find you on the internet if you don't mind sharing those details?
I don't mind. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and recently TikTok as at Dr. Dave Coyle, DrDaveCoyle. And other than that, it's easily Googleable. Dave Coyle, Clemson University. Pops right up.
I want to follow you on TikTok. Kentucky Bugs, look for us here soon. Okay. Your friend on TikTok.
I'm still working on that, man. Don't expect a lot.
I got an intern to do it. So I've got a young intern. Person that's cool. And hip. And
yeah.
We appreciate you being on the show, David. It's been awesome catching up with you and hearing about your experiences with a few different invasive species. Mm-hmm. If folks want to find the show online, we are at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. We're on Twitter, arthro_podshow. If you want to find us on podcatchers, it's just arthro-pod. Always include the dash. Otherwise, you won't be able to find us on Spotify and those other places. I'm on Twitter at BugmanJohn.
I'm on Twitter at JodyBugsMeUNL.
And I'm on Twitter at mscavarla36.
Until next time, we hope that everybody's settling in for the fall and the winter and holidays and everything. And we will be back with more entomology entertainment here in a couple weeks.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
And it goes back to my modeling days at UW, you know? Do you guys know I like modeled for real for Gempler's catalog?
No.
No.
Saw that on Twitter.
Gempler's. It's like horticulture pesticide clothes and stuff. So I would like hold pliers, you know, and like model Band-Aids. And there's one where I've got like, there's a pretty, the picture you probably saw, Mike, is probably wearing the safety vest.
Yes. Yep.
Safety vest and a hard hat stuff, toolboxes.
We need to get that on in the podcast show notes.
Oh my God, I can send it. I think I've actually got